Hi, this is Linda Holmes. We hope that you will support your local public radio station at donate.npr.org/happy. And a little later in the show, we're going to tell you more about why. Call Me By Your Name has been an awards contender for almost a year since it premiered at Sundance in January. Based on the novel of the same name, it stars Timothy Chalamet as a 17-year-old who falls in love with a graduate student played by Armie Hammer.
Directed by Luca Guadagnino, from a script by James Ivory, Call Me By Your Name is starting to rack up Critics Awards. We're talking about it with Bob Mondello today on Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Little Passports. Every month, kids can explore a new country when packages arrive in the mail filled with activities, souvenirs, maps, stickers, and more. Or try Science Expeditions, which delivers exciting hands-on experiments and STEM activities every month. Little Passports has subscriptions and gifts for kids of all ages. Find special offers for our listeners at littlepassports.com/popculture.
Welcome back. I'm here with Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And with us, as always, is NPR Music's Stephen Thompson. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
And in our fourth chair today is NPR's film critic, Bob Mondello. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
Hey, Linda. Good to be here.
So Call Me By Your Name is a film that Bob and I both saw in Toronto. Glenn, I wanted to talk to you first because I haven't heard from you about this film yet because you read the book.
Yep.
And have spoken to me about the book.
Yeah.
So you always say that when you read a book, you remember tone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in your thoughts about the tone of the book and the tone of the film.
Okay. They're both about longing. They're both about this kind of full body ache of a first initial obsession with somebody else. Now, I've said on the show many times that romance isn't my jam because there's only so many ways that two people can come together. And if that's true in life, it's certainly true in movies because it's just a matter of which cliche you lean on, right? It's the grand sweeping romantic gesture, the love triangle, the funny friend, the meet cute, all of that stuff. Now, that's not to ding romance in particular. That's true of any genre. There's just stuff that you have to lean on, a storytelling infrastructure. The reason that this film hit me and this book hit me so deeply is because of representation, not just because there's queer desire on screen and I experience queer desire, but representation has an aesthetic quality to it. When you start to tell the stories that have not yet been told, that have not been bled dry of any kind of ability to move us, you are forced as an artist to innovate, to subvert, to interrogate, to make something new. And it's these two characters in this very specific time, like they do not have access to the storytelling tropes that we've seen millions of times. Ain't nobody standing outside nobody else's window with a boombox in this movie because they can't.
Yeah. And right? When is this set approximately?
83. In a very Roman Catholic Italy. Everything that is communicated between these characters, certainly in the beginning of the film, has to be coded, layered, nuanced. And that is just inherently more interesting. I think representation means better art.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The film, to me, is so tone forward,
right,
if I can say that.
Yeah.
Rather than being plot forward or even dialogue forward, it is tone forward. Does it have kind of the same quality as the book in that way?
If anything, to me, the film feels more swoony and romantic because the book is told from Elio's point of view.
Elio is the 17-year-old.
And he is a very interior character. He's a kind of an introvert, and he thinks a lot. And the entire book is about these signals that he's sending off that he might not be getting back.
Yeah.
There's a whole lovely runner in the book about how he starts to impute all these motivations onto the color of bathing suits that Oliver is wearing that day, which feels so true. Now,
yeah,
a lesser filmmaker, a lesser screenwriter would have shunted all of that work, all that lovely prose, just done it in voiceover,
yep,
but instead it's all happening on their faces. It's all happening in the acting, and it's a big gamble, but it pays off hugely. You just feel the fact that they're not connecting when they desperately want to.
Now, you read the book first,
yeah,
true? Because I read it after. I read it having no idea. I saw the movie and thought, this is wonderful. I've got to read about these characters. and started reading, and I got it like 100 pages in, and I was still saying to myself, this is not possible. You can't turn this into a movie. This, right. this wouldn't work. Right. And I've already seen the movie at that point, but there's no way this could work as a movie because there's almost no dialogue in the book. Nobody says anything. Nobody connects for the longest time, and you think, how are they going to do that? Which is what makes the movie so fascinating. It's gorgeous to watch. And I think in a lot of respects, it does the book a great service in making you wait, making you wait the way that Elio has to wait in the novel for a sign one way or the other that something's happening.
Yeah. Stephen, what did you think?
I loved it. I did not read the book. I went into it fairly cold. And going into it as a fairly cold audience member, I watched it, especially at first, in anticipation of conflict. You're watching a gay love story unfold in 1983, and as this movie unfolds, there is no mention of the AIDS crisis. There is no gay bashing. There are no disapproving parents. There's no judgy teenagers. It is a love story that is allowed to unfold in a petri dish and just be about itself and be this very touching and romantic story. And the fact that it's a story without conflict really does mean, like Linda said, that it relies very heavily on tone, but it does so beautifully. I thought the performance of Timothée Chalamet as Elio is such an incredibly impressive performance. And it's not just how much acting he's doing with his face. There's a physicality to him in the love scenes that spoke to my, there's this like almost kind of sheepdogish quality where he's bounding around Armie Hammer, kind of climbing on him awkwardly and then kind of pushing him away and then grabbing at him. And it's this, like, you have all this physical energy and all this, I mean, you can say lust, but it's also just excitement. And that plays out in such a subtle way, but it was also like I saw something very, very universal in it and was really smitten with it.
Right, because the barriers to them getting together are cultural, but they're also internal, right? They're external, but there's also hormonal in a very real way. It's fascinating to watch.
Yeah, one of the things that I like about the Armie Hammer performance is how opaque Oliver is early on. He has a kind of a cool guy glibness, or superficial glibness, I should say, that really makes you wonder, is he really paying attention to Elio at all? Is he feeling any of this? Is he just a sort of, you know, the guy that you would fall in love with at summer camp who would never notice you? They make it feel plausible that it could be that, I think, at the beginning. And one of the things I really like about it as a love story is that it's very common in a love story, in a movie, for there to be one person who's kind of fully forthcoming in a kind of swoony, aggressive way, and one person who is, well, doubtful for whatever variety of internal and external reasons, as you say, Glenn. And I think the way they play with those dynamics without, you know, without specifying too much, I think the way they play with those dynamics between these two guys and where their hesitancy is, and also how they navigate getting to the point where they're even acknowledging that this is what they're talking about.
Right.
There's a scene that they play around a sort of a monument where they're walking around it, and it's so subtle how it's done that you couldn't, if you tried to kind of explain on paper exactly what's happening, it's all in the performances. And I really like both of these performances. I think the Armie Hammer character, you know, Oliver is a one of those characters who I think is harder to get right than it sometimes seems like it is. It's partly just like a confident, attractive dude, but there's way more going on with that guy than this. Now, Glenn, you mentioned the kind of the cultural barriers, the internal, external. One of the things that's come up as people have seen this movie is there is this age difference between Elio is 17 and Oliver's, I think, 24? And is a graduate student. And that's an age difference that for a lot of people, including me, it's uncomfortable. Little bit. It's certainly something where you have to be very, very careful about the circumstances, particularly if you are trying to make sure that the 17-year-old is well cared for.
No, absolutely. Andre Aciman, who wrote the novel, He made it up, right? He could have written this story about two 24-year-olds. He did not.
Or made him an 18-year-old.
Or made him an 18-year-old. Or, you know, this discomfiture that we're experiencing with this movie is part of the energy of this movie.
Yeah.
The fact that they are holding themselves, well, Oliver is holding himself back. He's doing that for a reason. That creates this longing even more. It's messy. It's intentionally messy, but we're supposed to feel that. I mean, it's about coming of age, first love, this helpless obsession. And again, it's another obstacle. Oliver is the one who keeps saying, no, and then eventually he says yes. But again, we're conditioned by decades of romantic narratives to want these two people to get together. And the fact that one of them is 17 is messy. The story and the movie go out of their way to establish that intellectually, at least, they are equals.
Yeah.
Elio is a very child
precocious,
prodigy,
right.
Very precocious, very smart, very intelligent. Not that doesn't mean that they're emotionally ready. And so the people who say, look, this is still an adult and a teenager have a point.
And it's made more complex in the movie than it was in the book because Armie Hammer is himself not 24. He is 31.
I was going to say, and I think
so that's older than 24.
He reads older. And that makes it visually tricky.
Mm-hmm. And Timothée Chalamet is 21.
Right, he's 21 and playing 17, but persuasively playing
right.
17.
He yeah. Is, you know. Yeah, but I think it's okay for it to live in that place that Glenn was talking about, where like, this is messy. This mm-hmm. is yeah. a messy situation. I think that's part of the story, is that this is a messy situation. That's one of the reasons why it plays out the way it does.
Exactly.
And I don't think you have to feel like I'm totally comfortable with this to hear the story and take the story in and not feel like the story is a story of exploitation of a teenager by an adult.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that this is a movie, when you talk about it as a messy love story, it is fascinating that it is a messy love story entirely because of internal forces instead of external forces.
Exactly.
It really removes so many of the traditional external forces.
Right, yeah. And that scene toward the end where they're in Rome, I think it is, and it's deserted, and it's the middle of the night, and they're in an alley, and they're happy, and they're horny. We, queer audiences, are conditioned to experience that and then wait. Wait
right.
for the bashing. Wait
yeah.
for the police. Wait for because
wait
we,
for disaster to strike.
Yeah.
When we do this to ourselves, when we make queer movies, when queer artists make queer movies, we still have that. There is a punishment
yeah.
that has to come. And the yeah. fact that it doesn't in this particular movie feels like nothing else than a gift. And as much as this film will come under criticism for depicting a adult and a teenager, there are other people, a lot of gay critics I'm reading, who want it to be more sexually explicit. Because this Guadagnino is known for movies like I Am Love and A Bigger Splash, which use sex scenes to characterize people. That's one of his things. That's one of the things he does. And the fact that we literally cut away to the gently wafting curtains as soon as these two get together is just, you know, I mean, I kind of wish in a way that the movie proof rocked up, you know, it rolled its trousers, dared to eat a peach, like happens in the book.
I get
the book.
It. I get it.
I was going to say, my experience is always floating away to the curtains. It's uniform in my experience as a gay man. I think those beautifully wafting curtains are part of the beauty of this movie. That has everything to do with that statue coming up out of the deep and looking like it's just come up from a swim, or cradling a fish. There's this fish that's brought in, and the guy who has caught it brings it and shows it to Elio, and then takes it to the woman who is going to cook it, and she cradles it. She holds it in her arms as if it were a baby and takes it into the kitchen. And I just thought, that is breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
That is just, it's so beautiful. There are scenes in this movie that are in the movie exclusively to be gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's just gorgeous. It makes you feel like you're in Italy in the middle of the summer.
Yeah.
They spent 11 years apparently trying to make this movie, unable to do it because they'd encounter some kind of difficulty in the summer. And it can't really be filmed in the fall in Italy. It wouldn't work. They also had my favorite tidbit about this movie is that at one point, the person who was going to play Oliver was Shia LaBeouf. And that would make such
a different movie.
Oh my God, yeah. Different.
It would. And when you talk about the the aesthetic of the movie and some of the things that it's doing with visuals. My other favorite visual kind of theme in this film is bicycles.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's something about bicycles in film, and I think you can find this back in movies that star kids like E.T. and even in, you know, now in Stranger Things, but also in Breaking Away,
sure.
which is a wonderful,
yeah.
There's something about bicycles and coming of age stories that I think drives home this idea of freedom because
yeah.
both because you have to feel safe in a certain way to be willing to bike everywhere, and also because bicycles are so much a part of independence for adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
And this film makes great use of bicycles and travel as a element of this, as an element of this story. And it's one of the things I really loved about it.
I did want to mention Michael Stuhlbarg's performance.
Oh, boy. One of my favorites.
I think we're going to hear about that one a little bit more at award season because he has a very Oscar-clippy monologue.
Yes, he does.
That just made me blubber all over the place.
Yeah,
as a parent. He's in three movies that could very well be nominated for Best Picture this year, by the way.
Yeah.
He is everywhere.
So is Timothée Chalamet.
He is one of those actors where all of a sudden you feel like maybe you've not paid attention to him, even if you've ever seen him. And then all of a sudden he has this year where he emerges. But that Stuhlbarg scene, on the one hand, it does feel clippy and it's so sad
to
me. It's so sad to me that we're sort of conditioned to see a great scene as awards bait. And I don't disagree with you, but that is a beautiful scene and also an incredibly unusual scene. It's very, very uncommon what the film is doing with Elio's parents. And it's one of those things when I saw it emerge and when I realized what was unfolding, I sort of thought, this is nothing I expected from them. And of course, I will add, please, if you see this film, do not turn it off or walk out of the theater when the credits start.
Right.
Watch all the way through the credits. It's really important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that final shot to me says so much about how layered and interesting the story is.
It's not at all painful to watch another 10 seconds of this
no.
movie. I mean, it's just like, it's ravishing.
No, it's very generous toward its characters.
Yes.
It's very, I think, good-hearted and you know, beautiful to watch, as we have said. All right, well, I will be very curious to hear what you think about Call Me By Your Name. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Well, we want to hear what you think about Call Me By Your Name. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. If you want to show your support for our show, there is a new way to do that, which sometimes you guys have asked us, how do I support your show? If you go to donate.npr.org/happy, you can donate to your local public radio station on behalf of, you know, how much you love Pop Culture Happy Hour, as we love you. You know, we've explained before, the public radio system is what keeps us going. It's what keeps the whole system going. So show your support for your local station, donate.npr.org/happy. And if you decide to donate, also throw the hashtag in there, why public radio, and tell us why you're donating and why public radio plays the role that I'm sure it does in your life. And thanks so much to those of you who have already done it,
yes,
and those of you who will in the future. P.S. Stephen would want me to mention that we're in a pitched battle with Sam Sanders.
That's right.
To get the most support.
There may be a dance-off.
There might be
point.
A dance-off.
I challenged him to do the stanky leg.
Oh, that's right.
In a dance-off.
That's right. Nothing, as I told Sam, nothing is too petty for me. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find Bob Mondello at Bob_Mondello on Twitter. Thank you so much for being with us, Bob.
It was a joy.
And if you have a second and you are so inclined, give us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps more folks to find the show. Thanks to you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here on Friday.